MacCast, Sunday, November 25th, 2018. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you. Yes, yet another week of Apple Mac news and some great tips and tricks and feedback and all that sort of stuff from you, the members of the MacCast community. Thanks for being here with me. I probably don't say that enough. We just had Thanksgiving, and that gets me thinking about how great this community is and how thankful I am that you are here listening to this podcast. The show obviously wouldn't happen without you. I've been doing this for almost 15 years now, is it? At least 14. And it has been great since the very beginning. So thank you for everything you do, subscribing to the podcast, supporting the podcast in whatever way, whether you have ever sent in a comment or sent me an email or just if you even listen, I really, really do appreciate it. So thank you so much for that. And of course, this week we have a few things to get into and talk about, some Apple news to discuss. Unfortunately, you know, more kind of troubling news for iPhone, although we'll get into my thoughts on how troubling I think that is. A little deal going on between Apple and Amazon that may impact how you buy Apple products through Amazon, if you buy Apple products through Amazon. Also, more stuff on Apple's mapping data. There's some AI news this week. They maybe bought a company. Seems like they did, at least. And also, we'll get into some of the latest Apple ads and a little TV thing to talk about that is interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about it, but we'll get into that. And then, of course, we've got some great feedback from you. Going to get into iOS gestures and some of the little hidden features that you may have missed. And then I received a great question and some comments on File Vault and security best practices for your Macintosh from a listener. And because it's a security-related question, we invited an old friend of the MacCast back on the show who we haven't heard from in a while, our friend George Starcher, to talk about security and those sorts of things. So that'll round out this episode of the MacCast. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk to you about PDF Pen. You know, it's the ultimate tool for editing PDFs. It is one of those bits of software that I have on every device, every Mac that I own. And I probably don't go a week without opening up PDF Pen on one of my devices for some reason or another. Typically, it's to fill out forms, like documents. I get a lot of digital documents, like a lot of us do, and many of them are what I call fake forms, right? They look like a form, but they don't actually have form fields. So you often end up printing them out and then filling them out and scanning them back in. What a mess. You don't have to do that with PDF Pen. You can drop it right in there, add your own form fields, fill it out, add a signature to it, make small corrections if you need to do that. And those are the kinds of things that I'm doing. I also do that for my clients. A lot of times they'll have forms that they want me to convert into PDF forms, and PDF Pen Pro has this awesome feature called Create Form Fields from Page, and it will actually go through and recognize where form fields should be, you know, because typically there's a line there where that would be. It can turn that automatically into forms, and of course, you can add other form elements and things like that. So it is great for that as well. So if you're going paperless, it does OCR. It's great for marking up and highlighting your PDFs. You can add, insert, and remove pages, correct text, make adjustments to images. You can even record and playback annotations in a PDF using PDF Pen. And if you get the Pro version, you get those great things like creating fillable PDF form fields. You can add table of contents. You can convert websites into PDFs, even long, you know, really long web pages. Great for offline browsing, or if you just have documentation or content that might be HTML content that you actually want a PDF version of, something maybe you throw into iBooks or something like that. So great and valuable piece of software for so many reasons. One of those ones, once you buy it and have it in your library, you're going to find you're using it over and over again. You can learn more about PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro, as well as all of Smile's great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. And of course, a huge thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. So another week has gone by, and we're still getting reports that Apple is cutting back on iPhone component orders from their suppliers. Actually, we're hearing this from multiple suppliers at this point, many of them saying they are lowering their earnings expectations for the next quarter because a major client is pulling back on component orders, and that's assumed to be Apple. These are suppliers supplying components for the latest versions of the iPhone. That combined with claims that Apple is seeing weaker than expected demand from a lot of analysts for their iPhone lineup this year has just really created a lot of tension, a lot of frustration among investors. And if you've been watching Apple's stock price this past week, you know what I'm talking about. We're seeing the results. It's taken a pretty heavy hit. Now, there could be a lot of other reasons for that. Again, we're no stock experts on here, and I do have to disclose in my retirement fund, I do have a small amount of Apple stock. So just take that for what it is. But yeah, things are not looking good. And one issue being cited for the problem is Apple just offering maybe too many choices to consumers when it comes to iPhones, especially when it comes to older models still in the lineup that are offering cheaper prices like the iPhone 7, iPhone 8. I think the market is, and we've been talking about this here on the MacCast, it is responding to Apple's increased pricing and maybe not in such a positive way. You know, really the truth is going to be bore out with Apple's first quarter results of 2019. Those would be the results for the fourth quarter, the holiday quarter of this year, and that will really be the proof in the pudding, although it's going to be a little bit harder to determine this time around because at the last quarterly results call, Apple did say they're not going to do unit numbers anymore. So we're only going to get, you know, earnings, profit, those sorts of things, and those are probably still going to look good, but that's not really going to tell us, you know, which models of iPhone did Apple actually really sell. And the speculation right now is that they are selling more iPhone 8s than, say, the iPhone XS and XR, and thus we're seeing these component pullbacks. That's the allegation, at least. Apple has always said you can't sort of judge what's going on by the supply chain. And actually, historically, that's proven to be true because oftentimes we've heard reports, oh, the iPhone isn't selling well. We heard this with the iPhone X. Come to find out, it was one of the best-selling models of smartphones Apple has ever created, and you know those rumors turned out not to be true. So always kind of take these with a grain of salt, but we are hearing that Apple has cut order levels across all three models, and again hearing this week that they've revised down iPhone XR orders, which would seem really odd going into the holiday buying season. So maybe they just over-ramped up and they're cutting back, but we are hearing that iPhone XR orders have been cut by up to a third, which is significant. And the Wall Street Journal is also reporting this week that Apple is lowering prices on the iPhone XR in Japan. Now, they're doing it by offering subsidies to Japanese carriers, but there seems to be some price sensitivity in Japan as well, with a lot of people opting to go with an iPhone 8 model. And it's become very popular, supposedly, in the region, according to that report, and Apple making some adjustments. Also, as part of this Wall Street Journal report, they say that Apple is restarting production of the iPhone 10. Yes, not the 10S or the, you know, 10R, but the actual 10N model in certain markets. Now, there's some weird speculation about why they're doing this. One of the reports says that they are doing it in part because of contract requirements that they have with Samsung Display, that they needed to order a certain number of OLED panels, and that the new models that are using OLEDs, the iPhone XS, and XS Max, aren't meeting that requirement. Apple Insider says this seems unlikely because you wouldn't think that Apple would make that kind of deal. So it's probably more that Apple does historically release some older models in certain markets where there is demand for that. So iPhone 10 probably has some demand in some market. They do this in India, for example, with the iPhone 6S, which they still make and sell there, and also the SE. So there's could be a number of different reasons. So you kind of have to, again, when looking at these reports, take them for what they are and then really think about what's really going on maybe under the hood. A lot of this stuff is always just speculation, and I like to bring it up on the show just because it's great to have a conversation about and be aware of, but I don't think there's any time for panic. Now, if we get into the next quarter of the results and they're way, way off from what we're expecting them to be, or even Apple's guidance, which this time around was pretty conservative, and that actually did play into some of the stock concerns, then I think we have something to talk about or maybe something to worry about. But, you know, it's worth noting that in the past we have often heard about reports of, you know, order cuts and component cuts from suppliers, only to then have Apple go into the quarterly results and have record-breaking numbers. So, you know, they've been conservative, and these are interesting things to think about and look at. But until we actually have numbers or results to sort it out, I don't think there's any time for panic. And the one thing that is really surprising to me in these is that the iPhone XR is not seeming to be as popular as even I thought it was going to be. I think it is probably the best phone in Apple's lineup this year, but maybe people aren't agreeing with me. And again, maybe that price point is getting a little bit hard for people to swallow. I mean, the iPhone XR is still very much at a premium phone price. And then if you look at something like the iPhone 8 or the iPhone 8 Plus, which on paper, on spec-wise, competes with it very, very well, but is you know, $100-$200 cheaper, maybe that is something that people are responding to, especially in very price sensitive markets. People are also choosing to maybe wait to upgrade longer, but I think I still hold hope for the iPhone XR personally. I think that a lot of this is what we saw with maybe the iPhone SE and some of the other lower cost models that are more, I think, consumer focused for Apple. You know, not the early adopters. I think they're kind of slow starters, in my opinion. And I think over time, those orders will ramp up as people start to get in their upgrade cycle to where they want to upgrade. I think you're going to see a lot of consumers opting for the iPhone XR, but I could be wrong. Maybe the iPhone 8 ends up being what they're choosing because they are price sensitive. I'd be really curious to hear some of your thoughts on this. So if you want to shoot me some feedback or send me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and I look forward to hearing from you on this. Amazon and Apple have brokered a deal that may impact how you buy products, or which products, or more, I guess, correctly, who you buy products from on Amazon. There, we got there. I knew I was going to get there. Amazon will soon be an Apple-authorized reseller, and along with that, Apple brokered a deal to make some changes to the rules about how Apple products are sold on Amazon's website. Apple and Amazon are going to now only allow Apple-authorized resellers to sell Apple products on Amazon, and that's going to start January 4th of 2019. And so that means a lot of smaller resellers, a lot of resellers that are maybe selling refurbished or used products, are not going to be able to do that through Amazon anymore. I think ultimately it's going to be a good thing for consumers. Apple really wants to make sure that when you're buying an Apple product, you're getting the best possible experience. And that's part of what their Apple authorized reseller program is all about. But, you know, it does make it harder for smaller independent retailers to maybe compete with the larger guys, the people that can become an Apple authorized reseller, because the requirements are not easy. I looked into this a little bit, and it turns out that you need to have an existing account in good standing with an Apple authorized distributor. So those are the people you'd be buying the Apple products wholesale from. You need to agree to buy a minimum of $100,000 worth of certified Apple products a year from that distributor. You have to be certified. You have to have all your business and insurance in place, which you should anyway if you're going to be a legitimate business, but that is another part of it. You need to pass an application process to become an Apple authorized reseller. So these are not easy things to do, but it does help ensure that you as a consumer are getting protected. You know, Apple wants to make sure that these companies understand their policies, their return policies, all of those sorts of things. But it will change, you know, kinds of the kinds of products or the kinds of stores that you're seeing through Amazon that are selling Apple products. So it'll be an interesting change. But I think, you know, if you've been on Amazon, I always try to make sure when I'm buying something, I look for that shipped and sold by Amazon, you know, information that's on there, or at least that it's being shipped by Amazon. I often worry about the smaller independent guys who are shipping directly because you just don't know who they are. And you feel like you're buying from Amazon and it's safe, But at the end of the day, you know, what is your protection? I think Apple is recognizing that they want to protect their brand. They want to protect that consumer experience a little bit better. And I think that's what this deal was all about. So, again, I think it's ultimately pretty good. But I'm curious, too. Do you agree or not agree? Let me know. I think a couple episodes back, we had been talking about some of Apple's renewed mapping efforts, and in one of the stories, someone had spotted a pedestrian, a guy with a Apple Maps backpack with a bunch of sensors sticking out the top and like GPS and LiDAR and those things walking around the streets of San Francisco. They were spotted in the Bay Area, and this week, Apple has now confirmed that, yep, their Maps team is out collecting pedestrian data in California, and they're going to be doing more of it over the next month, starting with various counties in California, Alameda, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Cruz, and Santa Clara. So if you happen to be walking around in those areas or driving around in those areas, you might see some of this Apple Maps team with these backpacks on. And basically what they're trying to do is route some of the areas that maybe vehicles can't get to. Also, oftentimes, if you've used walking data from Apple currently, you know that the path is usually the same sorts of paths that go along the streets that cars go on, and that may not always be the fastest path through a city because you do have shortcuts and walking paths and those sorts of things. So Apple trying to get a little more data, a little more ground data on walking routes and pedestrian routes in cities and the places that they're mapping, which is ultimately good, right? This is all about them trying to rebuild their map data from the ground up, have it be their own first-party data. And as we talked about, I think, on the last episode of the MacCast, you can see the results of this in the map of California. If you go into Apple Maps on your iOS device or on your Mac and just zoom in, you'll see the level of detail about halfway down California. So if you start at the northern border and go to about the mid-level, you'll see a lot more green. And you start zooming in and you see a lot more street detail, a lot more detail about parks and pedestrian spaces and sports venues and those sorts of things. And there is a hard line across the middle of California where that data ends. So this is all part of that. And I would expect the Northern California data to get even better with this new pedestrian mapping. So that's pretty cool. Apple does say it plans to roll out its improved mapping data across the United States over the next year, so all through 2019. I hope they get done with California pretty quickly because I would like to see some of those benefits. But yeah, they want to have a broader rollout. No word on how quickly and which areas they're going to start with or roll out, but expect it to happen. You know, they're kind of playing catch up with Google, right? So I think they have a vested interest in getting this done as quickly as possible. They are obviously putting teams of people and a lot of technology behind it, and these little things of seeing folks in backpacks and stuff like that, that is the, you know, physical result of that effort. And it's nice to see. I think a lot of us are very excited about it. I don't think it can come fast enough, fast enough, but it takes time. This is stuff that's really, really hard to do. But it is their latest effort to take further steps to improve walking directions and other data for pedestrians. And I think ultimately it's going to result in a really, really great mapping system. I wish they had started it years ago, and I think a lot of us feel the same way. And we still don't know when they're going to start rolling this stuff out internationally, but I would expect that those efforts have to get started up pretty soon, again, because of the amount of time it takes to do this sort of thing. So I would think in 2019 we're going to see more international efforts at this level as well. But stay tuned for that. We'll find out if that's actually something that happens. A couple of new ads dropped this week, and I just wanted to comment on one of them. I normally don't comment on Apple ads because they roll out different ones all the time, and really they're a visual thing. So on an audio podcast, you know, it's really the kind of thing you want to go out and see and talk about. But Apple came out with their holiday ad this week. It's called Share Your Gifts, and I absolutely loved it. I thought it was wonderful. It had a great song by Billie Eilish. I'll have a link to the YouTube video in case you haven't seen it in the show notes at mattcast.com. But it uses this great combination of miniature sets and then CGI sort of layered over the top of that. And it's this whole story about a girl. She's a writer, creative person, but she keeps writing stuff and sort of just boxing it away in a box and keeping it for herself. And it's all about, you know, if you're a creative person, if you're just somebody who has a talent, I guess, any kind of talent, we all have our own talents, and maybe that's the point too. It's to get out there and share that with the world. Don't be afraid to share that. I thought it was a great holiday message. It's great branding for Apple and just really, really well done. So well worth your time to go view that. I think it's a, you know, a couple minutes long, two minutes, 2.5 minutes or something like that. So check that out. I think you're really going to enjoy it. The other ad that they put out this week might be a little bit more controversial, and it plays right into a lot of the conversations we've been having over the last few episodes of the MacCast. This one was an iPad Pro ad, and it is the 5 reasons iPad Pro can be your next computer. Yeah, right? Controversial. For sure. We're having this whole debate. Can an iPad Pro be your computer? You know my opinion on it already. I think it can for a lot of people. As a matter of fact, I have people in my life whose only computer is an iPad Pro. My mom, she only owns an iPad or an iPad. It's not even an iPad Pro. It's just an iPad. But she has really specific computing requirements, right? And it works for her and it's easy. She doesn't have a lot of hassle with it. I like it because I don't have to do a lot of tech support. She can figure out most things on it on her own. Now, as you start to get into that pro arena, things get a little more specific. And again, if you want to know more about that conversation, go back and listen to the last few episodes of the MacCast. We've covered that pretty well. But just to kind of summarize this ad, Apple's 5 reasons, and I want to talk about these a little bit because I think they're interesting, are 1, more powerful than most computers. I think that's great. It's more, though, I think, touting Apple's processor prowess, you know, their ability to design really great processors, which is a good, it's a toot your own horn kind of thing. But considering you're talking about a different operating system, you're talking about different applications that are running on that operating system in the real world. Yeah, it may be on paper is more powerful than most computers. Ultimately, it's what you're able to do with it. And you are able to do some amazing, powerful things on an iPad. Those things might be, though, very different than what you might do on a Mac or another computer. So, yeah, okay, we can kind of, sure, it's a fact. I don't know if that is a reason an iPad Pro can be your next computer. It certainly makes you feel better about or less concerned that you are going to be at a disadvantage because it's underpowered or something like that, I guess. So the other thing was they say it's a scanner, it's a camera, it's an editing suite, it's a notepad, it's a cinema, it's a music studio, it's a book, it's a computer. Point being there is that it can do all the things that what I think most people think of as a traditional computer can do. And that is very much true. It's all dependent upon the software and also, again, the individual user experience. But yeah, I can buy into that. And as a person who uses an iPad as a computer, I do a lot of the prep now for the MacCast, my show notes, a lot of my research, all those sorts of things. My MacBook Pro has basically become a desktop and I record the podcast on it. But other than that, everything else is done on my iPad for the most part. So yeah, it works at that level. Another thing, the third point was it goes anywhere. That's because some iPads have LTE support, which means you can get internet connectivity almost anywhere you are. And that's great, but many would argue, well, Apple doesn't offer an LTE version of a notebook. And if they did, that might be the choice for some person. So yeah, there, that's a good one. Easy to use interface. You know, they show things like split screen and drag and drop. I think a lot of people might argue there. Yes, it's an easy to use interface. It's much more simplified, I think, than a desktop computer, and there's some advantages to that. But there are also, as many power users will point out, some disadvantages, especially when it comes to things like true multitasking, those sorts of things. And of course, Apple doesn't address things like attaching external storage, which is a whole other thing. Again, if you want to know more about that, go back and listen to some of the previous episodes of the MacCast. And then the last part was even better with an Apple Pencil, which is great. You know, Apple Pencil is great for a lot of applications, especially if you're doing drawing or note-taking and those sorts of things. And it does put it at an advantage above a standard laptop or desktop Mac from Apple. But is that a reason why it can be your next computer? I think it's a nice, hey, it it's a nice addition to your computing experience, but so is a Wacom tablet. So I don't know. It's an interesting ad, certainly debatable, but it does show Apple's thinking, I think, in a big way, that they are really positioning the iPad as a computer option for a lot of people. And really what's interesting to me about that is who they are competing with is themselves, right? This is Apple's classic, we're going to use our products to cannibalize our products. They're saying buy an iPad Pro instead of maybe a MacBook Air or a MacBook to some people. And that is interesting to think about. And I'm not really sure what that means for the future of the Mac or the iPad. And actually, that's not even true. As I say that, I know exactly what that means. That means that Apple really does truly believe in the iPad as a computing platform. And I think they are going to position it as the platform for the majority of their customers, like it or not. And maybe this is the summation of the conversation that we've been having. And I just haven't said it until now. I think in the future, more people are going to be using iPad or iPad-like devices from Apple as their main computing platform. And the desktops and the Macs and the MacBook Pros and those sorts of things are going to be more specialized entities. They are going to be for specific types of users who need specific types of workflows. And we're already starting to see that a lot, I think. And there's a lot of people that just use smartphones, honestly, as their main computing platform because that works for them. And it's funny when we get into these conversations because I will hear a lot of pushback from people in the community that this isn't a real thing. But I think if you stop and look around, I've been trying to do this more. There are a lot of people that just don't use computers in the ways a lot of us do. And I think ultimately the analogy that Steve Jobs started out when he announced the iPad was, you know, that truck analogy, that car truck analogy. Most people drive around in cars, not trucks, because they don't need the specialized things that trucks provide. And I think it's going to become the same way with computers. A lot of people have pretty basic computer needs in terms of email and surfing the internet and maybe doing a little bit of writing here or there. And a lot of those needs can be serviced by something like an iPad. And because of the simplicity and, you know, they're easier to use, that is probably the right option for them. Why buy a truck or a specialized thing when you don't need that specialized technology? And some people will go, well, what if you change your mind at some point? Well, you can always upgrade to something else, or you can buy that computer in the future when your needs change. But, you know, you typically buy the tool for the thing that you're doing at the moment. And so I think that's sort of the point of all of this. But again, I'm happy to debate on this. I'm happy to take alternate opinions on this. Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. We heard about an acquisition this week, and as often happens with acquisitions from Apple, we don't hear about them for a really long time. This one actually happened earlier this year, but it is an artificial intelligence-focused acquisition. And this one is surrounding privacy, and as you know, privacy and security is something Apple is very focused on right now. It is a smaller deal. Apple purchased a company called Silk Labs. It was founded in 2015 by three former members of the Mozilla team. They had worked on the project to bring Firefox, or to build a Firefox OS. That didn't work out. It was sort of Mozilla's attempt to build a mobile operating system. The Silk Labs company they founded had about a dozen employees or so, so it wasn't very big, but they were focused on using artificial intelligence in ways to help protect user privacy. I think specifically more in small systems or embedded systems. It seems like they were focused on small devices and more broadly Internet of Things, which if you follow that segment is an area where there is a lot of security concern. A lot of companies are not looking at security of Internet of Things devices. And when we talk about Internet of Things, this is little appliances, you know, like when you connect your cat dish. Yes, it's happening, your cat dish to the internet, or your coffee maker, or, you know, all these different devices we're hooking up to the internet, a lot of companies are not looking at security. And one interesting product that this company made was something called Sense, or tried to make, I guess I should say, because it ultimately ended up being a failed Kickstarter project. I think they actually got the funding, but ultimately ended up canceling it. I don't know if it was because maybe Apple was sniffing around for an acquisition, but the Sense was a security camera and a smart home hub that was capable of recognizing your face. It had face detection, but it was all done internally on the device, right? It wasn't done out in the cloud, anything like that. But you could do facial recognition and then adjust the connected devices on your network based on shared preferences. So I'm thinking this is the kind of technology that might be really good in a multi-user HomePod, right? If the HomePod has the ability to recognize who is either speaking to it or has a video camera system on it that recognizes who is in the room or who might be talking to it, then can adjust its settings, connect to the right iCloud accounts, and manage things, that could be a really nice enhancement to a future HomePod. And because of Apple's concern over privacy and security, if that can happen all on device, that would be a really cool thing. And that's the kind of technology it looks like that this company was into. And there's obviously broader ranging applications for this. It could be worked into not only the HomePod, but other HomeKit devices, into your iPhone, into your iPad. You know, Apple wants to do more AI, more processing on device for privacy reasons. And I think that's really good. We've already heard about offline Siri that they're working on. So you'd be able to do a lot of your Siri commands without being connected to the internet, which would be awesome. So another good acquisition. Again, it's always interesting to me that we don't hear about these for a really long time. And Apple did not, as far as I saw, comment on this one, even with its standardized statement. So just another interesting thing to note on this story. And then finally in the news for this week, a little quick story, something that came to us from a site called The Information. They say Apple is considering the idea of producing a low-cost Apple TV dongle to compete with things like the Chromecast and the Amazon Fire Stick. Now, 9to5 Mac points out that right now, the Apple Siri remote actually would cost more than most streaming sticks. We really don't have an affordable Apple TV option at this point, or what I consider to be an affordable option. You got the $179 US Apple TV 4K, and I think if you go $20 cheaper or $30 cheaper, $149 for the Apple TV fourth generation. Yeah, Apple TV is not cheap, and so it would be nice to have some sort of option, especially going into 2019 when we think Apple is going to launch their own video streaming service and their own video content available to anybody who owns an Apple TV for free. That would be a great way to bolster and sort of boost the audience for that kind of product. And so we've heard about this rumor, you know, in the past, and it's never really come to fruition. I kind of also feel like Apple could just reduce the price of an Apple TV down to more of a sub, you know, back down to, I guess we were sub $100 at some point, $99, back to that price point, and that could grab a much bigger part of the market. But the idea here would be is you just have a little dongle. I would assume it wouldn't come with a remote, that you would simply use another Apple device, an iPad or an iPhone, with the remote app installed as your remote. And it could be an interesting product. It seems like the timing is right, so I can understand where this story is coming from. But I would also take this with a grain of salt, because as you know, with R&D, Apple is always looking at different kinds of form factors, different kinds of products. And so they do a lot of things in the lab. Sometimes this stuff leaks out and it never actually really becomes a product. But would I be surprised if we saw this sometime in 2019, maybe at an announcement where they talk about their new video streaming service? No, I wouldn't be shocked at all. And it could be really cool. Apple could do a really neat device in this vein. And I, for one, would be interested to see what they do. And if they can bring it in at like a $50 or even $30 price point, they would sell a whole lot of them, I believe. But that is the news for this week. That's all I got for you. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple other show sponsors, starting off with Ops Genie by Atlassian. You know, we all hate it when our favorite website or service goes down, even if it's just for a couple minutes. Think about Netflix or Amazon or iCloud. When you can't get to it, yeah, it impacts you. You become a very unhappy customer. But that is nothing in comparison to how it affects those of you who have to manage and maintain those services. You know, those people who are out there on dev and ops teams, you really are the unsung heroes of outages like this. You have to jump in and be able to respond at a moment's notice. So luckily for you, there's Ops Genie from Atlassian. It is the tool you need, just like a utility belt, to get your job done. Ops Genie gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. It will help you notify all the right people throughout your organization using a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones and holidays, making sure that the right employees get the notifications when they're ready to respond. It allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where your alerts are deployed, and it's supported by over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. Plus, it tracks all of that activity and provides useful insights to help you improve future incident responses. With Ops Genie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit opsgenie.com and you can sign up now for a free company account and add up to 5 team members completely free. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank LinkedIn Jobs. You know, the right hire can have a huge impact on your business. When I was working for Nick Software, we needed to hire a programmer, and I remember going through this process, and it was rough. There was an amazing number of unqualified leads that we had to sift through, and even after we got the right ones, finding the exact right person who was the exact right fit was really difficult. And ultimately, we found a great candidate, and that is really important because the reason you're hiring is to get someone who can jump right in and fill a role and do the job well. And that's great for morale. If you get the right person, it brings everybody up. And that's why it's so important to find that right person. But where do you find them? You can use job boards or services, but really, are all the candidates you might want there? Is that where they're hanging out? What about candidates who might be considering a new job but haven't jumped on the job boards yet? They haven't committed to that process yet. And really think about it. How often are you hanging out on job boards? Really only when you're actively looking for a job, but you might still be considering one. And that's why using LinkedIn is such a great choice, because people on LinkedIn, they're already hanging out there every day, making connections, looking to grow their career, discovering job opportunities. 70% of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn. So posting on LinkedIn is really the best way to get your job opportunity in front of the right people. And these are people who are qualified for your role and are ready for something new. It's the best way to find a new person who can help your business grow. And that's why a new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn. So hurry to linkedin.com/MacCastJobs and you will get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/MacCastJobs to get $50 off your first job post. linkedin.com/MacCastJobs. Terms and conditions apply, and a big thank you to LinkedIn Jobs for their support of the MacCast. A topic that I bring up on the MacCast from time to time is something that I call Apple's hidden user interface elements or hidden user interface. These are all the little, and it really started with iOS, all the little sort of gestures and things that aren't really well exposed when you're using the operating system just naturally, but little things that you kind of need to either hear about, know about, read about in a tip somewhere to really discover these sort of undiscoverable or undiscovered user interface elements. I don't know. I don't know what the best terminology for that. Like, really, I just call them Apple's hidden UI. And I'm bringing it up this week because it kind of came up again. A lot of people, for some reason, and I think it started out on social media or on Twitter or something like that, a lot of people started discovering the keyboard trackpad trick in iOS. And you yourself might be going right now, Adam, what are you talking about? I don't know what the keyboard trackpad trick is. Well, this was something that Apple added back, I think, when they first added 3D touch to a device. And I don't remember which version of the operating system. It might have been iOS 10 or iOS 11. And I think it was with the iPhone 6 that this came out. But if you had a device that had 3D touch and you brought up the keyboard, and it might have only been on the phone. I think it was only on the phones at first. But on the keyboard, if you did a 3D touch, a force press on that keyboard, it would change the keyboard into like a little trackpad, and you could control and move the insertion bar in a block of text. So the idea was it was an easier way to help you sort of zone in and put the insertion bar in a specific point in a block of text. And it was sort of like this trackpad that you could activate. And over the years, Apple extended it. So at a certain point, they added it to iPads. And of course, iPads don't have 3D touch. So they changed the gesture a little bit. It wasn't a force press anymore. It was simply a tap and hold on the space bar, and then you could activate it. And they even further extended it in iOS 12, because you used to not be able to do it on phones that didn't offer 3D touch. But with the new haptic touch that's like on the iPhone XR and even older devices now that don't have 3D touch, with iOS 12, you can also do this gesture as well. You can tap and hold on the space bar, and it will give you the little insertion point, and you can drag your finger around like a trackpad and move that on the screen. As a matter of fact, you can also do a selection with it. So as you have it activated in that little trackpad mode, if you tap with a second finger, that will set a starting insertion point, and then you can drag and drag out a selection to select a block of text. And it is a really handy little gesture, but unless I told you about it, or you had somehow discovered it on your own, or you read it in an article, you might not know that gesture ever existed. Some people, you know, accidentally stumble across it because they just rest their finger a little bit too long on the space bar. But really, how do you discover that? There's no indicator anywhere when you're using the keyboard that that is even a thing. And that's sort of the features that we're talking about here. And so I thought it would be a good topic to bring up on the MacCast and say, what other sort of hidden gesture features are out there that you use that maybe some of us don't know about? And I know we've covered on the past force touch and 3D touch gestures, so don't send any of those in. We kind of already covered that. So I get that, you know, force press on an icon and I can get additional options, those sorts of things. We're really looking for ones that don't require 3D touch. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Hopefully there's still some left over after this. But, you know, one of my favorite ones, and one that I use a lot and has been around for forever, is if you're in a long page of text. Typically this comes up on a web page. You've scrolled all the way down to the bottom and you want to jump all the way back up to the top of that page. You may or may not know that you can tap on the status bar at the top of your iPhone, or just at the notch if you have an iPhone with a notch, and it will jump and scroll all the way to the top. I use this in also Tweetbot, my main Twitter application. It works in a lot of applications that deal with long scrolling text, and it's kind of become this universal gesture. But if you didn't know about it, it would be a hard one to necessarily discover. Another one is if you have a full screen iPhone, so one that does not have a home button, and you're in the springboard, you're on the main application launcher, and you're several pages in, and you want to jump back to the very first page, if you just quick swipe up or flick up on the indicator bar at the bottom, that will return you straight back to the home screen. Now, if you have a device with a button, you know you can just tap the home button and it'll jump you all the way back. So that's the similar gesture. Another one, again, if you have the little home indicator bar, so you have an iPhone 10, 10S, 10S Max, or a new iPhone 10R, you can swipe left and right on the home indicator bar to switch between open applications. So if you're in an app and you want to quickly switch to the others, you can just one by one sort of page through them by swiping on that home indicator bar left to right. Another kind of hidden gesture that has become a universal one, and one that I will often use when I'm in an app and I want to know how to search for something. This is true for apps like the Files app or Documents by Readle, or like Reader, I think the app that I use to do my RSS feeds, the search bar in a lot of cases is sort of hidden. I call it above the fold or above the top of the screen, right? So if you're in a big list, oftentimes if you just pull down, you can reveal additional controls and in a lot of cases, a search bar or a search box. And a lot of apps have taken to that gesture as well. And again, it's totally hidden until you discover it. There's also the classic one of Shake to Undo. A lot of people, I'm surprised how many people I will mention Shake to Undo to, and they will have never heard of it before. So you're in an app, you make a mistake, you want to do an undo. It doesn't have an undo button. Try shaking your device, and a lot of times it will pop up with a dialog box asking you if you want to undo or redo the last action. So that's a handy little one. The last one that I have is one of my favorites from iOS 12. It's a new one in Notification Center. So if you're in Notification Center and you see your notifications, you can now swipe from the right to the left to get some additional options. And if you sort of, as you're swiping, you'll see you get some additional buttons. The one that I really like is one called Manage that lets you on the fly manage how you're dealing with notifications for a specific app in Notification Center. So one of the new options you have is an option called Deliver Quietly. And what Deliver Quietly allows you to do is tell a notification, hey, I still want you to show up in Notification Center, but no longer give me any kind of sound or alert banner or alert box on the main screen. Just go right into the Notification Center sort of silently, and then I will review you later. And then you can kind of turn that on or off by doing this swipe gesture from right to left on that notification in Notification Center and activating the tapping on Manage and then changing the Deliver Quietly options. And you can toggle that back and forth as you see fit. So those are some of my hidden gestures that I use from time to time. I'm sure you have some of your own that I haven't mentioned. If you do, shoot us some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. All right, the last thing that I have for you today, and this is going to be a little bit longer segment because we're going to bring in our friend George Starcher to help answer this question, is a question I received, a question and a comment related to security best practices on your Mac and File Vault. And it came to us from listener Don. So here is what Don had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Don Cornelius. And I just had a comment and a question about your security section on your November 18th episode. First, the comment is about a File Vault and disk encryption. So to my knowledge, the file system becomes unencrypted. When you're using File Vault, the file system is unencrypted the first time you log in. So let's say you power on the laptop and then you log in, the file system becomes unencrypted. Let's say you now lock the screen, you walk away, you close the lid, or you just lock the screen, you walk away, the file system stays unencrypted. So you get your best protection when the device is powered off. And the same is true of iOS on your phone, on your iPad. It's the same thing. The first time you power it on, once you put in your passcode, then the file system is unencrypted. So the safest mode when you have encryption on is to simply have it turned off. And I don't know if there's a best practice around that. I can't imagine wanting to turn off my devices and walk away every time I want to get some coffee. But that leads to my question. Is there, specifically for Macs, is there a best practice application that you could think of that you might recommend? Something like an OpenSCAP, maybe? Something that would be good to recommend to a good number of people who are concerned but don't necessarily have experience on all the little things you might want to turn on or turn off. I can tell you one of the things that I do is for my accounts, I do use two-factor authentication. For my Macs, I do use File Vault. And in addition, I set a firmware password, which is something when you have to go into the rescue mode of the Mac, you can set a password for your firmware. And what that does is that it disables that disk transfer that you can either do over the Thunderbolt port or the FireWire port, so that even if your machine is turned off, someone can't just turn it on and then copy your disk image off and then maybe unencrypt it over a period of time. It's a little bit paranoid, but it's a thing. And then I was wondering, when you're looking at general recommendations for turning on or turning off all the things to make the system more secure, those things change if you have a system with a new T2 chip. So I'm wondering what kind of advice would you give for the people like that? So that's all. I know this is a long message. Thanks for the show. Bye.
Hey, no worries about the length of the message. That's totally fine. And there was a lot to cover in there, and I wanted to do my best to address your concerns and your comments and things like that. And I am not a security expert. I only play one on the internet. But luckily, I do have a friend who works in the security field and has helped us out here on the MacCast from time to time. And that friend is George Starcher. So I thought this would be a great question for us to sort of tag team. I grabbed George, sat down, and here's the conversation that we had because of your comment and question, Don. So thank you for that. Hey, George, thanks for agreeing to come on and help me out with this question here.
Sure, no problem.
It's a little, not a little outside of my wheelhouse. I mean, we've dealt with this stuff before in the past, and I want to thank you for, you know, again, coming back on.
It's been How many years has this show been running?
yeah, it's been a little while. But, you know, every once in a while, this kind of security question, just privacy question comes up, and I think it's important to kind of hit on some of the key points of it. And with this one, really the main thing that I want to address is just some general confusion about how FileVault and FileVault 2 works. And I think in this clip, the concern is correct, right? The concern about access to the data and when you have access to hard disk data and being aware of when that is, I think is really, really important.
Sure. It's all about scoping your risk, right?
Yeah. But the general technical part of it is where there gets to be a little bit of confusion. So we're going to try to decrypt all of that. no pun intended.
I see what you did there.
I didn't do that intentionally. I really didn't. Demystify whatever, like we do here on the MacCast, explain that to people. But I did want to start off with one thing that was mentioned in the clip, which is something I had never heard of before, OpenSCAP. And definitely, I believe what's being referenced here is he wants some sort of standards place where we could look at home and Mac security and go to and say, hey, here's a list of best practices. You know, what should we be doing to secure data on our Macs and things like that? And I don't know that anything like that exists. But just to explain OpenSCAP, it's something from, I think, the folks at Red Hat, although it is open source. It's security policies and frameworks and best practices. And when I looked at it, it looked like it was mainly geared towards sysadmins and IT administrators and stuff like that. So if you're like managing assets at a corporation or a company or you know, like you're working for an e-commerce organization, you know, what are the things that you should be doing to secure your equipment and your data and protect
And it includes some auditing tools and stuff to whatever posture you settle on out of that framework that you want to use.
So definitely not relevant in the scope of what we're talking about here, but relevant in terms of, the concept behind it, the idea of what this listener is asking for, which is, you know, where is a source, where is a place that I can go to and just learn the best practices as a Mac owner, as a user of iOS devices or Apple products for, you know, what I should be doing to protect my security and data. And I don't think we really have one resource for that.
No, I don't know that there's a really good, solid one that covers, you know, especially like all the iterations of the different versions of the operating system as they exist and what's still supported versus unsupported beyond Apple's own miscellaneous knowledge base articles. You'd have to dig through them, right? So there's not a good, concise thing. Probably the OpenSCAP isn't a bad place to start, though.
Right. So this is, you know, for our audience and for the people listening, I think we try and do that here on the show. And that's a little bit about what this segment is about. So let's just jump right into the whole FileVault thing and the disk being unencrypted when your machine is unlocked. And that's where there's a little bit of technical confusion, I think. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep. So first off, if you're still running a version of a Mac that's using FileVault 1, stop. just seriously upgrade. File Vault 1 was horrible. And, you know, I mean, you and I both remember, we, even in the, you know, earlier days of the show, people calling in with horror stories of it ate itself and they lost their stuff. Just don't do it.
Yeah, it was bad technology.
Yeah, with File Vault 2, I have never had a problem.
And I should have looked this up beforehand, but I mean, we've had File Vault 2 for years now. I don't remember.
Yeah, like,
I can't forget which version of the operating system it updated.
Probably pushing 5 years, I'm guessing, but yeah. I don't remember exactly.
So chances are, if you're running any modern operating system, and you should be, just for other security and privacy reasons, then you know, you should always be running the very latest that your machine will support. Now, I will admit, I have in my house one machine that's still running Snow Leopard, because it's a 2006 Mac Mini, and that's the latest version it will support. And it's just a file server, you know.
But anything that's openly supported by Apple is going to be pretty much new enough to be File Vault 2.
So, yeah, definitely get on File Vault 2. But, yeah, so, I mean, under the hood, how does it work? Because this comes up a lot. People do get concerned. I've been asked this question more than once. You know, how is File Vault protecting me when I'm logged into my account and my machine is open and unlocked? And the reality is, it's not, right? I mean, if someone has physical open access to your machine logged into your account, in all scenarios, almost all bets are off.
Yeah. Physical access always wins in that sense. But, you know, the operating system, when you turn on File Vault, it encrypts the data that's on the drive at rest, right? It uses, and I believe they called it, you know, core storage, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's drivers involved. So once you log into your laptop and provide the passphrase for the account so that it in essence mounts the data. The data is still encrypted. It does not decrypt it. It just allows you unencrypted mounted access, which means you know, like when you're opening files, it's all transparent to you. Any malware or any other software that runs as you in the user context of the running operating system is going to see that data just fine. But if someone like stole the laptop because you turned your head at the coffee shop, if they can't get in as you, meaning like if you've locked it and they can't do something like, you know, in some of the older Macs, we've heard of like what they call direct memory access attacks through Thunderbolt and FireWire type port vulnerabilities, where they can attach a cable and use another machine to read the RAM, where, again, in the older systems previous to the T2 chip, all those encryption keys or stuff that are in RAM, and that could let a very sophisticated attacker bypass the encryption in the long term with some effort. Mm-hmm. But honestly, if your use case is I turn my head at my coffee shop and some dude just took my laptop and ran out the door, that person's going to be pawning it. The thing's going to be reset. They're not going to be in your stuff. As long as you locked it and File Vault was encrypted, they're not going to be in your data, right?
Right. So the key becomes the setting in security and privacy in general of require password after sleep or screensaver begins, and you can set that to immediately. So if you close the lid on your laptop, it's immediately going into a locked state and your data is encrypted. And I would assume, therefore, protected against, you know,
the processes that are still running, you know, behind the screen lock, it's, you know, can still see the operating system. But if someone just took the laptop and, you know, they reboot it or whatever, if they can't unlock it as you, they're not getting into it. They're most likely going to end up having to reboot the laptop. They'll reset it, which means they'll lose access to all the data anyway.
Right. And at that point, the data on the drive is encrypted.
Yeah, it's still encrypted. It's never unencrypted. It's just a matter of whether they are in that running process space of seeing it, you know, through the mounted driver, right?
Right.
So, okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, I mean, really, that's sort of what I wanted to explain. We also need to talk a little bit, I think, about the T2 chip. And then I just want to wrap up giving folks, you know, just kind of some best realistic practices, right, that they could be using to, you know, make sure they're doing at least the I don't want to say minimum, because I think we want more than minimum, but, you know, using some best practices to protect their data in a reasonable fashion, right?
Sure. Now, when you talked about the screen lock, one thing I do as well is I go in my screensaver settings and my desktop settings, and I rig the hot corner of the top left to auto-engage the screensaver immediately.
Yep, I do that too.
I literally have muscle memory built up over years where I just go swipe and I throw the cursor up to the top left, instantly locks the laptop.
Yep. I mean, and again, that coupled with it requiring a password once it immediately goes to screensaver or to sleep, or, I mean, you can change that. I think they have settings for 5 seconds, 1 minute. So if you want to avoid the, oops, I accidentally hit the sleep corner, you know, set it to 5 seconds and then it'll give you a chance to undo it. Yeah. To get it unlocked, but have it go pretty quickly. I mean, I feel like you want it to go to screen lock pretty, you know, required password pretty quickly, especially if you do have a laptop where you are concerned, hey, someone would, you know, run by and grab it off the table and run out of a Starbucks or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. Don't give them a chance. I mean, the minute they close the lid, it should lock itself.
Yeah. And like you said, too, he mentioned, you know, using two-factor on all your accounts. So obviously you need to have access to your data. So if you're using, you know, iCloud Drive and it's syncing off the latest operating system, you've got your two-factor enabled on your Apple accounts or your Google accounts, you know, all those things, so that you really want to treat the laptop in a lot of cases just like your iPad and iPhone, where it's all backed up, and if you lose the device, you can just replace it and put it back the way it was.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And another thing people need to remember is if you're using Time Machine, or if you're using disk encryption on an external, or if you're using external drive, you need to encrypt those disks as well. Now, Time Machine, at least in the latest versions of the operating systems, makes it pretty easy because there's just a checkbox.
Yeah, right, prompts you right away
in the options when you set it up, and you can just say, you know, encrypt my Time Machine as well. For your other drives, you're going to have to use, I think you have to do it through Disk Utility, right? Or through the Finder, I think you can also get info on it and encrypt those.
But you have to encrypt it as an extra step versus getting just prompted when you set it up.
Some people might forget that, because if you are, you know, Time Machine will run while you have while you have a File Vault encrypted drive, again, just for the same reasons you said, right? It's running, if you're logged into your account and it's there running as you, it can still back up your data, which is what you want. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
But if it's backing that up to an unencrypted external drive and someone were to steal that external drive, that drive is unencrypted.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
and he also mentioned the firmware password. So in the old days, people would set that, but it was kind of pointless because all you'd have to do is remove the storage, especially if it wasn't encrypted, right? If they didn't turn on File Vault, then they could pop the drive out, and the firmware password alone is just a boot password. These days with the T2 chip, it's a little more integrated, it also helps control the settings of whether it checks the operating systems and stuff like that. So that it has more relevance than it used to mm-hmm. set the firmware password. Go ahead.
Two things on that. So if you don't have a T2 chip, are those some of those benefits missing? And then secondarily, this is something, probably one of the things with a lot of more casual users I've had users, especially like in my user group or something like that, or even in the community here in the MacCast, who someone advises them to turn on the firmware password and they don't realize how sort of finite that is if you forget that password.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had, unfortunately, people come to me and say, I set a firmware password and I forgot it. What am I going to do? And the answer is you have now lost everything. Basically.
Yeah. You definitely change the game. Right. So you gotta,
right.
You gotta memorize it if you want. I honestly don't use the firmware password.
I don't either.
The Macs. I rely on a really good passphrase. Yes. My account.
Yeah, that's the other thing we should have mentioned earlier. The login password for your Mac should be a very good, secure password. I mean, that's key to all of this. Like, if you're not doing that, then all bets are off.
Yes. And typically that's the same thing. It's you, because you could technically start to get your user account password different from your firewall password, different from your firmware password, but then you got to get them all straight, right?
Right.
And again, if your adversary is someone that you're worried about it to that level, you know, pretty much law enforcement already knows who you are at that point.
Right.
And you got bigger problems.
And so what does the T2 chip add to the firmware password? And if I don't have a T2 chip, is there any?
Well, I think the firmware password is more useful these days for the Macs, even without the T2 chip, in that, you know, before, you know, someone could just pull the storage out,
right?
And then they don't care about the chassis, right? They would just pull out your drive. They could attach it to another Mac and then go after that.
Sure.
And the firmware password is going to make it harder for them to boot up with either an alternate operating system or something, again, to try to read the drive when it can't be removed. Because, you know, as we know nowadays, most of the storage is like soldered straight on the board.
Right.
And again, a sophisticated government level attacker or something like that, they're going to be able to do that, you know, desolder it and solder it up to something else. It'll take the chips out. But again, your average laptop thief is not going to do that. It also reduces the value of them selling it as a unit once it's reset. The T2 chip, from my reading on that, my work laptop has it. None of my personal ones do because they're older. Uh-huh. But the, you know, I mentioned like the direct memory attack and being able to pull keys out of the RAM because the system's up and it's technically mounted. All those keys are kept in the T2 chip. So I'm imagining, although I've not personally messed with it, is that since all those are maintained in the T2 chip, that such direct memory attacks are significantly reduced or even eliminated on those Macs, right? That they can't just pull the keys out by attaching to like the Lightning ports or Thunderbolt or, you know, whatever your particular model has. It also has a lot of features. And again, the links will be in the show notes to Apple's knowledge base articles on the T2 chip. But it also controls where the settings are of how thoroughly it checks alternate operating systems, whether it's only trusted by Apple recently, whether it's not trusted at all, or whether it has to be an absolutely current signed version of the operating system to make it less likely that someone's going to be able to boot up with some sort of malicious operating system or altered one in order to, you know, trick you into logging in and getting into your stuff.
Right. So I guess that brings me to my question about all this. So if we're talking about alternate attacks, I mean, let's just say someone gets your laptop and they boot it into target disk mode. They, you know, can rip the storage out and put it in another thing. They, you know, boot into the recovery partition and they try and access things that way. If you're using FileVault 2 and you're using a really good secure password for that, I mean, what are the risks? What is the level of risk that they are going to actually get at?
Yeah, you're going to need a nation state or high level law enforcement coming after you for them to get around that.
Right. So, you know, your average off the street person is not going to, I mean, and again, I think that's another thing to remember about this, that the guy that's swiping your laptop from Starbucks off a table or something like that is probably more interested in selling your system than getting it. Although more and more these days, you know, I don't want to be dismissive of that either. There are a lot of people that are looking for personal data for doing exploits, you know, in other ways, you know,
or even your identity. A lot of people that, you know, bad relationships, and it's your personal laptop and your significant other one's all up in your business.
Right.
Right. I mean, sometimes the adversary is closer to you. And
probably more often, I would imagine.
Yeah, more often, right? So that's, again, you got to look at your own risk profile and who your adversary technically is to decide how much of that you need to be doing.
And who are you worried about? So the question is, who are you worried about getting this data?
Yep.
And who do you think might be trying to get this data is probably even the bigger question.
Yeah. Now, I do have an app that I run on my personal laptop because it's an older, as a matter of fact, it's one of the original MacBook Pro Retina 13s. Uh-huh. So no T2 chip, no fingerprint sensors, you know, none of that. And I use a app called Do Not Stir by Objective-C. I use a security researcher, and it's just $10 a year. And there's an iOS app that goes with it. So like if someone opens up my laptop and let's say I didn't shut it down, I just simply put it to sleep by closing the lid, right? And I left it laying around, so it opens up the lid. The moment the thing wakes up, as long as it's got a network connection, which usually it's probably going to have the local Wi-Fi wherever it's sitting, then the app talks back to their servers, and then I get a push notification on the app on my phone. It says my laptop's been awakened. I can press a button and make the camera take a picture. I could tell it to lock and shut down. I could actually make it shut down the laptop. I mean, there's also, you know, with Apple's own Find My iDevice feature, you can right. do some of the, you know, similar things.
I hate that they call it Find My iPhone, but it was Find My Mac, I guess. So you can use Find My Mac to, you know, remote shutdown, remote wipe, remote lock, all those sorts of things.
Yeah. You may not be able to use the camera. And of course, the camera feature is kind of, you know, a little gimmicky, because if you've got a camera thing over your camera, like I keep mine right. covered.
A lot of people do that.
Yeah. Or the bad guys, just again, if they're savvy and they're regular laptop thieves, they're going to throw something over
the camera. They'll put a piece of tape over it, right?
Yeah, you know.
Or a Post-it isn't too hard to come by.
Yeah, I imagine not. But again, it's a process that's running under my user context, so the laptop has to be booted in the sleep for it to serve any function, and it also has to be able to join whatever local network, you know. So again, it's where you are in that threat chain, right? Do you usually leave your laptop thing down?
It'll queue up though, right? Like, so if it detects an event and there isn't a Wi-Fi.
It should.
Once it hits
the Wi-Fi. So if it finally gets on Wi-Fi, then the messages will come through.
Yeah. So that's cool. I mean, that's another layer of protection. I mean, there's a lot of software out there. I know people who use the, other third-party tools for kind of doing the Find mm-hmm. My iPhone thing, and some of them maybe have some deeper features, you know, for like tracking, like LoJack style, you know, tracking of your laptop and stuff like that. I'm pretty happy with just Find My Mac is, you know, what I use.
Yeah, that's pretty much the point I've gotten to. I mean, long as my data's backed up, it's backed up into accounts that are two-factor protected, I treat the device as disposable in that sense. And if it gets stolen, it gets stolen. I know they're not in my business, and it just becomes an insurance claim.
Right.
Right. Which let me bring this up, because I had to deal with something similar recently where my ex-in-laws had some devices stolen. Make sure you are recording the serial number of your devices, like in your 1Password, someplace like that, that's off device. Because my former mother-in-law had her phone and iPad stolen. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, they still had the boxes that had the full serial numbers handy. But logging into their iCloud account, like via the Apple support app, mm-hmm. the Apple support app masks most of the serial number. So it's not a good way to look up your serial number to give it to the police for a police report, for instance.
Oh, if you've registered your devices through My Apple ID, are those not available?
Well, I just know that I, at the time, because I was kind of in a hurry because I had to run over and help them, I logged into the support app.
Oh yeah,
you know, where you might support, make it, and you can't it's do it. Partially, it's almost 90% obscured there.
Yes, absolutely.
Whether it's showing someplace else the actual full serial number, I did not look that hard. Yep. But the simple point is, just make copies of your serial numbers and which gear it is, and put it someplace safe. Yeah.
Cool. So I think, you know, just to kind of wrap things up, I mean, we've covered a few of, I think, the best practices, right? You'd use a really good secure password on your main account, right? Mm-hmm. I think another one that we didn't really mention, but probably goes without saying, is use a password manager, right?
Yep.
Make sure you're using different logins on all your different services and those sorts of things. Use a password manager to manage that. And also, just like you said, make sure you're putting other important data in there, like your serial numbers. You know, put those in those secure vaults and have them sync to other devices and keep all that stuff secure. Use File Vault too. People think I'm sometimes crazy because they have had those bad experiences in the past, but I've been using File Vault 2 for years now and had zero issues with it whatsoever. It doesn't impact me on a daily basis. I don't notice it. And my data is encrypted and protected when my Mac is asleep or powered off, right?
Yep. I've had the exact same experience. Turn it on.
Well, actually encrypted all the time as we talked about, but you know, at least locked down when my machine is asleep. If you're more concerned, some sort of remote tool like the Do Not Disturb or additional tools to help you track and get more data if an event happens can be good. Do you have any other things other than the Do Not Disturb? I know Objective-C, they make a number of different tools.
Yeah, it's a security researcher. He's making all sorts of nifty little things all the time.
You know,
that's just the one I happen to use.
Yeah, and there is a lot of stuff out there. We don't have time to cover all of it. Maybe in some future episodes we can get into some other tools. But, you know, there's lots of things that you can do if you are more concerned about this. And I guess so maybe the last thing to do is just, you know, do some of your own research. There's lots of stuff available on Google. We will continue to look. And if someone does know of a single sort of resource for Mac security, actually Objective-C is probably a good place because I know that the developer there does blog and talk a lot about security stuff.
Yeah, he's a security researcher. He's doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so check out the blog over there. Like I said, he does have a number of tools that you can check out. I don't know that there's a single resource for sort of best practices. It might be nice for someone to create that. You know, maybe you're listening to this now and you're in the community and maybe you want to take that on as your job. And that would be cool. And let us know about it if you do. But other than that, hopefully this helps kind of explain things with respect to this question. And hopefully we've demystified some security things. Anything else, George, before we wrap up?
No, just you and all your workouts lately, pinging my Apple Watch, making me feel guilty.
Yeah, trying to get a little bit healthier. I've seen you on there too, though, so don't sell yourself short. But yeah, I think that's it. So is there anything you want to let people know about that you're up to these days? Or
nah, I mean, I'm pretty much just doing my own thing these days. I'm not super, just work and,
Well, at the very least, a good guy to go know if you're looking for Mac security stuff. You can probably ping George on Twitter or something like that, and he might be able to help you out with some of these things. And we'll try to get you back on the MacCast a little bit more too. I know it's been a long time. It's just we haven't had for good or bad, I guess, security questions pop up recently.
I guess in a sense that's hopefully good because it's so baked in these days, right?
Yeah.
Again, these fundamental things, you do these key things, that's going to be good enough for most everybody.
Cool. Well, thanks, George, again.
Hey, there you go, George Starcher. And thanks to George again for helping me out with that question. Also, thanks to you, Don, for your questions and comments. I hope that kind of helped out with some of those things. I feel like we didn't get to the one big answer is that source, right? One source for sort of data security best practices on the Mac. We covered a little bit of the things that we do, I guess, but it certainly isn't everything. And if you do have a recommendation, if you do know of a website that's really good for this, I know, there's some podcasts out there. Security Now is a big popular one. I think that's Steve Gibson's podcast, right? There's a couple other security podcasts out that you could follow or listen to. That might be another way to go. So if you do have recommendations in that regard, shoot us some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. I'd also like to thank my Patreon supporters, those of you who support the MacCast directly via Patreon. Thank you so much for doing that. If you would like to help out and support the MacCast through Patreon, you can get more information and details by visiting patreon.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-622-4269. MacIam9, and you can leave a voicemail message there. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.